Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We are continuing our conversation about his book, A Little History of Archaeology. Brian, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure, as always, to talk with you.
Yes, and for me too.
This is such a wonderful book, and I cannot recommend this highly enough. I mean, this is like, there's a lot of interest in archaeology. If you ever really want to know the whole ins and outs and the history of it, and in a way that's fascinating, this is The Little History of Archaeology will do it. The last third of this book, Brian, really traces some of the major changes in the science of archaeology in the 20th century. And to the reader, at least to me, it seemed like the pace of change in the 20th century in archaeology was breathtaking. It really totally revolutionized the science.
Oh, yes. A huge number of things happened. I think the biggest two impacts have been the huge partnership now between the sciences, using the word in a very broad sense, and archaeologists, and also the enormous number of archaeologists now around the world. I mean, back in 1920, archaeology was a village. Now, in terms of people, it's a small city.
Let's talk about a few of the things mentioned at the end of the book. For me, one of the things I've always wondered about, I wanted to know how it developed, and radiocarbon dating, which changes everything. How were things dated before radiocarbon dating?
They were dated in all sorts of rather indirect ways. One way, of course, was dating, deciphering hieroglyphs and dating Egyptian king lists and other historical events. But that only goes back at the most 5,000 years, and you've got a lot of time before then. Then there's tree ring chronology, where you count tree rings, which in those days was only really developed in the southwest of the United States. That went back 2,000 years. When I tell you that tree rings now go back 8,000 BC, the change is huge. But the rest was a blank, and the way it was done was basically by guessing and correlating across Europe using artifacts, looking for imports of objects of known age in the heart of Europe and so on. It was very largely guesswork.
Now, how does radiocarbon dating work, just in a nutshell?
It basically measures the decay of carbon-14 in organic materials, which the weight of which is known, and you calculate from there. In recent years, it's got very sophisticated and now can date organic things as small as a single seed, which, of course, has had a huge impact on, say, the history of agriculture.
So that changes for me when I read about carbon dating and potassium-argon dating. We're talking now that for these odd finds, like say Otzi, the frozen Alp German there, you can now more or less pretty accurately date that. Because before, I mean, when I look at that Iceman, there is nothing really around that you could have done tree rings or anything. You just had sort of guesswork. Now with carbon dating, you can really get it on the line.
Yes, and carbon-14 now, which is subject to extremely sophisticated statistical analyses, I am scientifically illiterate and don't really understand it, but they're now at the point where, for example, there's one so-called long barrow, a communal grave in England, dating to about just over 3,000 BC, which they now know was occupied for a finite number of generations. I mean, they're getting that sophisticated. And in the case of Otzi, where they've dated all the organic materials, he's really pretty closely dated.
Let's talk about Otzi for a minute, because for me, that's an exciting find. Boy, I'd love to see that, you know, up close and personal. I've certainly seen all the photographs. But he's sometimes
called... see it, or go to Austria and see it.
He's called the Iceman. He was found in the Alps in Germany. But the amazing thing is, here's this frozen corpse that's still got the skin on it. He looks a little bit like a mummy. But we're able to actually determine so much about by sophisticated analysis. We know what his last meal was.
Yep, and a cutting-edge medical technology now has told us more about his health than he knew. And we even know which. No, really. And the same with Ramesses II, the pharaoh. And then you've got information from isotopes and other things, which zones in on the valley south of the Alps where he lived with a young person. I mean, it's amazing what they're doing.
It's absolutely incredible. And and there were all sorts of other people that have been preserved. There were the bog people too. Yeah. I don't know why it is, but I find those archaeological finds absolutely fascinating because there's a person there. There's an actual person. We often read about sort of the grand sweep of archaeology in these big civilizations or towns and cities and stuff like that. But with these people like the bog people or Otzi, we're talking about a very specific person.
A person who once thought and talked.
Yeah.
And communicated. And it's a bit of a shock when you see them. It's not like finding a skeleton. I mean, there's skin and bones there. Some of the stuff they've done in Egypt with the medical conditions of people shows us that these people really suffered, for the sake of argument, from dental abscesses, which agony. I mean, you know, the past really comes alive.
It really is. One of the other things that seems to, and again, we're just talking in generalities about the last third of your book, is there seem to be archaeology branched off into different specialties. And one of them, which I love, is the science of palynology, palynology. Yep. That, talk to me about what that is.
Pollen analysis. It's the study of the minute vegetation pollens you find that float in the atmosphere. And this actually has a long history. It goes back to, I think it was the 1920s, even earlier maybe, where Scandinavian archaeologists traced vegetational changes just south of the northern ice sheets at the end of the Ice Age. And as the ice sheets retreated, the vegetation zones changed. And from this, they developed a sort of environmental framework for northern Europe, which still stands. And from there, they started dating hunting sites.
Wow.
Found in bogs. Now, it's got even more sophisticated. They're dating all kinds of things. They've even dated or identified plantation weeds in fields or in bogs, which date when fields were cleared during the New Stone Age. This is very precise stuff now and is of huge use studying, say, vegetational changes between ice sheets in the Ice Age, studying agriculture, diet, all kinds of things.
When I read these chapters in your book, it seems to me then archaeology is no longer a one-person job. Whereas there, you know, in the grand old days of the beginnings of archaeology, somebody would just do the digging and dig up the stuff and do the interpretation. Now you need people to do the radiocarbon dating. You might call in a palynologist to analyze the pollen, and the list sort of goes on. So it's really a collection of people who do any kind of archaeological analysis.
It's interesting because the early part of the history of archaeology is about individuals, great men and women who became heroic diggers and all the rest. And it's very interesting because now archaeology really is multidisciplinary teamwork and much of it highly specialized. I mean, there were people who were experts on Ice Age earthworms. There are people who are experts. You laugh, but it's very valuable.
Wow.
And things like that, which tell us about human behavior. A lot of those people have to be on site to recover the data. And and when I started in Africa back in the 60s, I think there were 9 archaeologists between Cape Town and Cairo, except for Egyptologists, of course, which is another world. And you did everything. We did the bones, we did the seeds, the lot. And it was very difficult and challenging. But today it's all specialists. And the days when you had great archaeologists or prominent, important archaeologists are slowly dying out now, and it's more and more teamwork, which is a good thing because there are fewer egos involved.
But there is a name that I associate with one of the great finds in the history of humanity, and that's Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania and the Leakeys. I was surprised that this was included in archaeology, and let me tell you why. I always thought that was more paleontology. And I guess I don't know where you draw the line.
You draw the line when people start making tools.
And
both Lewis and Mary Leakey, and I knew them personally, I knew them fairly well,
Oh, man.
were archaeologists. They were trained in stone tools and Stone Age archaeology, but they also, being both or him from Africa, had a great interest in game and animals, and they identified animal bones and realized that they were looking at early, very early human behavior, which was why these caches at Olduvai Gorge were so important. Their discoveries at Olduvai are really some of the most important ever made because they revolutionized human evolution or our knowledge of it.
Well, in the case of the Olduvai Gorge, we're not even talking about Homo sapiens.
No, we're not. We're talking about much earlier humans. We're talking about what is now known as Homo ergaster or erectus, who was an archaic human, which was found by Louis Leakey and Mary Leakey in 1960. And oddly enough, I visited them in the gorge.
Oh, man.
The day after they found it.
Oh, come on, Brian.
I was the first person to see it. And we've arranged a lovely sequel to this about 5 years ago. I was on.
Oh, man.
I was at Olduvai at the floor where they found Zinjanthropus. And I met Richard Leakey's wife, who's a charming lady, an extremely good scientist. And I said, well, the last time I was here when Leakey found Homo erectus, I was here the day after, and she looked at me and said, your history. It was lovely. He was a man larger than life.
Yeah.
He was very difficult, very opinionated, had a huge ego, but a mind like a razor. And Mary was a charming lady. She came to dinner at my house many years ago, and after dinner lit up a large cigar, and I swear it was 6 inches to a foot long.
Well,
this is a lovely person.
One of the great things about this part of your history is that there are several places where you literally are on the sites. And one of them is the next one. In China, Shi Huang Di's burial mound. And you write, and I love when I can get your sort of personal insights into this. First of all, that's a dramatic find. Anybody who's ever seen a picture of this, that's like an incredible, that's like something out of a storybook.
Have you by any chance been there?
No, I've only seen pictures of it.
I keep on assigning you places to go.
I know. I have a whole list of places I have to go, especially after reading this. For people who have never seen it, describe it briefly.
It's an enormous site. There is the burial mound, which they haven't touched quite rightly because scientifically they feel they're not qualified. The regiment, which is, of course, the symbolic regiment which guarded the emperor, is only partially exposed, and it's rows of standing soldiers. What you don't realize is all those figures have been painfully put together from the excavation, and they're still doing it. This is a 100-year conservation and digging project, and you don't go down in the pits. You walk around, and you can see it. It's just the scale of the thing which absolutely staggers you.
It's an army.
Yeah, it's an army.
Now,
officers, chariots, the whole bit.
Now, one of the things that some of these chapters then bring up are interesting questions, and you mentioned it, I think it was in this chapter. Should the needs of the tourist industry take priority over pure archaeology? That is a tough question for certain countries.
You keep on asking these tough questions. This is a terribly fundamental question, and it's becoming more and more serious to the point that, for example, on Rapa Nui, which is Easter Island, the authorities are now restricting the number of visitors.
Well, people don't realize that sometimes just the sheer number of presence of people are going to disturb the site. You just can't help it. And unfortunately, for some reason, in the last 10 years, there have been more and more cases of people purposely violating sites.
Actually, it's also happened in the Victorian times. There were numerous examples of people vandalizing sites. But you go to the Valley of the Kings at the height of the season, and you literally go through the tombs and files, and you can see the paint peeling off the walls.
Oh, wow.
You go to the Parthenon, and it's mobbed. They're all mobbed, which is wonderful. People are that interested in archaeology, but you're getting damage, say, to cave paintings where now facing an issue. What do you do? Build replicas like they've done at Lascaux?
Yep.
Or Do you just shut them forever, or do you divert people to other sites? There are no easy answers, and it's only recently that this is being taken seriously.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure talking to him, is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We're continuing our conversation about this wonderful book, and it's just a delightful history, and you learn so much by reading it, A Little History of Archaeology. One of the things I always thought was incredibly difficult to do, and again, I've seen pictures of it, and you devote a chapter to it, underwater archaeology. Well, who were the first people to attempt underwater archaeology?
Oh, there's a long history of trying to go underwater to find things, but it really developed with the development of the scuba diving gear and so on, and there were people who found Roman shipwrecks after War II. But the real pioneers, the most famous of them is George Bass, who was at Texas A&M of University of all places, where they founded a major center of nautical archaeology. And he made the point, and he was actually an expert on the Mycenaeans of Greece, he made the point that archaeology underwater is the same thing as archaeology on land. It just happens to be under the water. So the recording and collecting and everything and conservation is just as rigorous underwater as it is above water. And scientific underwater archaeology has become a major specialty and has found some dramatic things, of which the most famous probably is the Ulubaron ship, the Bronze Age ship
right
in South Turkey. It's absolutely fascinating what's come from that.
Now,
it's come from work in the lab, not work on the seafloor, ultimately.
Are there problems with uncovering objects underneath the water and then bringing them into the air?
It depends on the object. Obviously, with, for example, wood or leather, you mustn't let it dry out. And there are well-established conservation techniques for many of these things now, much of which involves slow drying and things like that. It's very sophisticated. And for 1 month of work underwater, you've probably got a year's work on land at least. It's very slow moving.
Oh, wow. And you're also dealing with the elements in a whole different way than you do on the land. I mean, obviously, the elements are always an issue. But once you start putting more than 10 feet of water and you're underneath that, there are major problems with the health of the diver, being careful about that, and then obviously air.
Fortunately, the technology is very well developed now. And operations like Texas A&M are rigorous with their safety procedures, and it really has been a remarkable thing. And a great deal of underwater archaeology is being done, and a great deal of it sort of away from the limelight.
Wow. Now, people may be very surprised as you get towards the end of your book to read that some of the best archaeologists no longer dig. And I was surprised about that. I mean, I knew these other things were available, but I didn't realize that it's gotten to that. And you have to explain that, because everybody's image of archaeology is the grand digs where everybody, and even underneath the water, you're uncovering things. But this is a surprise to everybody.
This is fascinating, because there are a lot of changes in archaeology that people are not aware of. We still have this stupid romantic 19th century view of dig, which is nonsense. It's now a highly rigorous discipline. And the fact of the matter is, a great deal of science can only be done in the lab. You may collect the samples in the field, but when you get into things like isotopic analysis of bones, or you get into minute details of metallurgy and so on, you really are lab-bound. And there were large numbers of archaeologists studying, say, ancient bone collections, seeds is a major one, things like that, who spend their whole careers in the lab. And the old days when you thought, people are no good if they are only diggers, which is absolute nonsense. I would say today people are now realizing just how important lab work is. For example, the analysis of the containers that once contained ancient beer and wine.
Yes.
They now go back to 3000 BC, if not earlier. It's good stuff.
But we've also developed technology called remote sensing, and
yes.
And this has also brought on a whole philosophy of non-intrusive archaeology. Talk about that.
Non-intrusive archaeology is the wave of the future, because the one thing that's happening, of course, is that the archaeological sites are finite and easily destroyed. And more people are getting seriously worried about the destruction of the finite archives of the past. What has happened at the same time is the development of extraordinary remote sensing technologies from space, of which LIDAR, the use of laser technology, is one of them. And this has done remarkable things because it can penetrate forest cover and has shown us, for example, a large quantities of the hinterland around Angkor Wat in Cambodia, which I think I put on your list.
Oh, yeah.
Maya sites where they've found entire villages and neighborhoods which cannot be detected because they're under rainforest. And this is a huge revolution and is really fostering the notion that one of the most important things we've got to do is look at landscape. In fact, the whole future of archaeology is, in a way, really up for grabs. It's fascinating.
In our final moments, talking about this book, I've got to, because you talk about being at Angkor Wat in the book, and talk about being at Minoan sites and all sorts of other sites. Of all the sites, which one personally, for not any serious scientific reason, but just personally, what site really knocked your socks off that really just caused you to stop in your tracks and open your jaw?
I think one of them that did. Now, it depends how you define opening your jaw.
Well, just blow your mind.
Oh, for spectacular, Angkor Wat. Amazing. For emotional impact, no question. This is an obscure one. Is and the site, Haida of Indian site of Ninstance, in Haida Gwaii on the so-called Queen Charlotte Islands off British Columbia, where the wooden totem poles from the 19th century village still stand. And
wow.
many of them are being allowed to decay back into the forest because they are poles that commemorate the ancestors, and the ancestors are the guardians of the environment. This is a deeply moving, quiet place. That I will never forget.
When I hear something like that, I immediately get worried about, so these pieces will not be around for future generations, but that's okay?
Yes, it is. These are Native American beliefs, and substantial samples of these totem poles are, in fact, in the British Columbia Provincial Museum in Victoria, where they removed many years ago to considerable controversy. What remains, I think, will just slowly recede. I hope it does, because this is huge respect for Native American beliefs.
Can you just say a word or two about Angkor Wat, because I'm sure most of the listeners don't know where that is.
Angkor Wat is in Cambodia in Southeast Asia. It was built by a guy called Soya Varman, who was a Khmer ruler. He was, I suspect, a megalomaniac. He created a state which revolved completely around him and was very hierarchical. And he built this extraordinary temple-stroke palace, which is a symbolic replica of the Hindu world of mountain, the sacred mountain and the oceans. And the thing that really shakes you about it is the enormous scale of the thing. And then when you walk in there, along the palace walls are huge bas-reliefs of the king advancing into armies, of markets, of people fishing, and gorgeous portraits or bas-reliefs of dancing celestial maidens. The whole place is just amazing. The trouble is, it's overwhelmed with visitors.
So I was going to ask you about that. Yeah,
it's absolutely mobbed, and the Cambodian government does not have the resources to really protect it. I would recommend also going to another site called Ta Prom, which is fairly close, which isn't that conserved, but it's marvelous because you go in there and you see these elaborate kapok trees and their roots kind of overgrowing the ruins.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Really very evocative. Go to the past to enjoy it. Don't just go and look at it and say, oh, this is 770 BC. That's nonsense. You can look at that and say it. Whoopee. Go to the Olympics, the stadium at Olympia, where the Olympic Games were, shut your eyes and imagine a race with the drunken audience and sacrificial oxen lowing and cheering and jeers and people falling and so on. That's what it's all about.
Is there an
noise and people?
Is there an area of the planet that we still is under investigated for archaeological remains?
Oh, huge areas. Much of Russia, much of China, Tibet, much of India and Pakistan, huge areas of desert in the Middle East, many parts of Africa. The list goes on and on and on. Oh, yeah, we've hardly started.
I have to read. I'm going to read the end of your book because I love it so. And this is a real inspiration. This gets to the heart of what you were talking about before. You end A Little History of Archaeology with these two sentences. The past is around us for all to experience and enjoy, not only archaeologists. So when you next visit an archaeological site, let your imagination run wild. And I have to say, the first time that I saw in the top end of Australia, I got to see all the paintings that had been done by the Gagaju Native Australians on the walls of the escarpment that had been there for so long. I stood there and then I looked at the landscape as they would look at it and then related to the pictures. And I'll tell you, it was one of the great experiences of my life. I mean, it's amazing to see archaeological remains that are so old. It really changes your life.
But then you've got the other dimension, which is the Australians themselves, who had elaborate cosmology and mythic beings behind the paintings, of which you knew, and this is no reflection on you, nothing.
No, we don't know anything about it. It was like
amazing stuff.
It was amazing stuff because you would see the people still living there. You'd see the Gagaju Aborigines. You'd see the Native Australians there. They would be meeting there and have their corroborees, and you realize we still don't know enough about their culture.
We are disgracefully ignorant of it. No, the point about archaeology, Mark, is this is about people. It's about all of us and how we behave. And that's what we forget.
It's where we came from.
Yeah.
My returning guest tonight is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And we've been continuing our conversation about just a wonderful small book, A Little History of Archaeology. It's a really inspiring. And again, he gave me a list of places to go. You'll get your own list of places to go of reading this book. Brian, it's a pleasure as always.
And a pleasure for me too, Mark. Thank you.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.